Every time she did this, Heilmor would sit in tense expectation of her awakening with nothing to report. He also said to tell you that his uncle's mood seems to have improved a little, she added. Well, that's something at least. Heilmor rose from his desk, pacing to the window to gaze at the placid waters outside. They were anchored off the southern shore of the Upper Torquil. Unwilling to sit idle whilst awaiting the Long Rifle's return, Heilmor had undertaken an ad hoc mapping operation of this inland sea. It was clear that the charts of this region, held by both the Maritime Protectorate and the Corventine Imperial Navy, were badly outdated and in sore need of revision. Besides which, he preferred to occupy the crew with something beyond yet more painting of the hull or another scrubbing of the bilge tanks. I thought I'd take a launch to shore tomorrow, Zanita said, joining him at the porthole. Akina hasn't set foot on dry land for months. Even for a Verestian, it's not good to lose touch with the Earth. With your permission, of course. Heilmor surveyed the shore, which was much more picturesque than the marshlands that surrounded the Quillam. Small rocky islands topped by trees proliferated amongst the many inlets and creeks, though any scenic appreciation was offset by the knowledge of what lay beyond. If you wish, he said. I'll send Mr. Talmont along with an escort.
Why not come yourself? Take a little time away from your charts. I know Akina would like that.
All she ever does is make fun of me when she's not cursing me in pirate slang.
That's why she would like it. And so would I.
Heilmor turned towards her, finding a wary but definite smile on her lips. They were conversing half Inverestian and half Mandanorian, as they often did when alone, which reminded him that she hadn't referred to him as Sea Brother for several days now. In Verestian culture, the absence of such formality between crewmates could have significant implications. The thought immediately summoned Luella's face to mind, and he looked away.
You have no obligations, he reminded himself. A broken engagement is just that, the absence of obligation.
I, he began, unsure as he spoke what his answer would be, then stopped as a palpable vibration thrummed through the deck beneath his feet. The sensation was accompanied by a loud keening sound that seemed to be coming from beneath the ship. He frowned at Zanita. Is that?
It's Jack, she said. And I believe that's a warning cry.
20 points off the starboard bow, sir, Talmont said, handing Heilmor a spyglass as he and Zanita rushed onto the bridge. About 2 miles out. Another to stern, similar distance. Chief Bosware has the auxiliary engine online and the Bloodburner is standing by. Anchors are being raised.
Heilmor settled the spyglass on a patch of sea, 2 miles beyond the bows, finding a familiar roiling to the Torquil's surface he had hoped never to see again. A quick check of the stern confirmed it.
Greens, and a damn sight more than we faced in the cut.
Well done, Mr. Talmont,
he said, lowering the glass and speaking swiftly but calmly.
Signal the chief to bring us to 1/3 auxiliary power. Mr. Scrimshine, steer due west, if you please.
He pulled the set of keys from the chain around his neck and handed it to Zanita, lowering his voice. Take every vial and report to the engine room. Tell the chief to pack the Bloodburner with as much product as he thinks she can take. Wait for my signal before firing it. She reached out to take the key, her hand closing over his and lingering for a second.
You owe me a trip to shore, she said,
before swiftly exiting the bridge.
Sound battle stations, Mr. Talmont, Heilmor
said, drawing his revolver and checking the cylinder.
Riflemen to the rail! All guns to load canister!
After the near-fatal confrontation in the cut, he had ordered Steelfine to see the conversion of half their remaining standard shells to canister. The armor-piercing warheads had been pried off and replaced with modified food cans filled with rifle bullets and whatever scrap metal they could find.
Such munitions were unlikely to prove as effective as true canister shot from an iron ship manufactory, but Halmore expected them to prove their worth if the range was short enough. He went out on the walkway, tracking his spyglass between the two approaching green packs. It seemed to him that perhaps every aquatic green in the upper Torquil had been mustered by the White's unseen but undeniable hand. Perhaps that's why it took them so long to return, he mused, gathering forces to make sure of us the next time.
Take us to full auxiliary power, Mr. Talmont,
he called over his shoulder as the Superior settled to midships, shifting his glass to the western horizon, finding it mercifully clear of enemies. Halmore returned to the bridge to plot their position on the map table. They were fast approaching the point where the upper Torquil narrowed north of the cut, meaning their overall speed would be reduced as they ran headlong into the morning tidal surge. The realization raised the uncomfortable suspicion that the timing of this attack might not be coincidental.
Signal the engine room, he told Talmont. Fire the blood burner.
Aye, sir.
Halmore moved to stand at Scrimshine's shoulder, peering through the bridge window. The blood burner came online an instant later, the choppier waters of the Narrows suddenly seeming to speed towards them as they surged to 30 knots, then beyond.
Got some more tight maneuvering for you, leading deckhand, Halmore told Scrimshine. Though I doubt it'll be quite as bad as the shelf. Think you're up to it?
Beg pardon, sir, Scrimshine said. But there ain't another hand on this tub I trust the job to.
Halmore didn't feel inclined to argue the point. The helmsman was probably right.
You know the course from here, he said. On through the Narrows to the cut. Once there, don't wait for orders. Take us straight through.
It'll be heavy going, sir, Scrimshine warned. Tide's likely to be fierce at this hour, even with the blood burner going.
If it's hard for us, it's hard for the Greens, Halmore said, turning away. Mr. Talmont, you have the bridge. Mr. Scrimshine's position is to be protected at all costs. I'll send 2 riflemen to assist.
Talmont saluted and drew his revolver.
Very good, sir. Mr. Steelfine,
Halmore called, as he descended the ladder to the deck, drawing up short as the islander's bulky form materialized at his shoulder almost immediately.
Muster all spare hands into a working party, Halmore ordered. Shift the port and starboard batteries to the stern, and stack up the canister for rapid loading.
Aye, sir.
The lieutenant strode off shouting orders as Halmore went aft, ordering 2 riflemen to the bridge and the rest to position themselves on the upper works.
No firing until they're at the rails,
he cautioned as they scrambled up the ladders. Moving to the stern, he trained his glass on the sea beyond the Superior's frothing wake, seeing the 2 groups of Greens beginning to converge 2 miles off.
They're within range, sir,
the aft battery's lead gunner pointed out.
Could throw out a salvo of steelheads, get a few at least.
Halmore shook his head.
Waste of powder. Save it for the canister.
It took over 1/4 hour to manhandle the port and starboard guns to the stern. When it was done, they had 5 muzzle-loading 13-pound cannon lined up side by side, each with a stack of 20 canister shells.
When the time comes, forget about accuracy,
Halmore told the gunners, all kneeling in readiness.
Rate of fire is more important just now. The Undaunted was my grandfather's favorite ship, and he was given to boasting that she had the best gunners in Protectorate history. 4 shots a minute in close action, he said. I always swore I'd beat that if I ever got the chance. Don't make me a liar, lads.
Aye, sir,
Steelfine barked, the others joining in with the enthusiasm of men facing death and keen for any source of encouragement. The fact that Halmore's grandfather, the legendary Commodore Racksmith, had never said any such thing was immaterial at this point. The Superior lurched as Scrimshine altered the angle of the rudder to center the bows on the fast-approaching cut. There was a noticeable drop in forward speed once the ship completed the turn, a wake broadening as the engine labored against the tide. Aylmore reckoned their speed to have reduced by at least a third. As ever in the moments before combat time became distorted, the agony of anticipation stretching seconds into minutes. Aylmore heard one of the gunners let out a gasp of relief as the roiling waters beyond the wake began to dissipate.
"Bastards are giving up," the man breathed, sagging a little, then straightening as Steelfine barked out a rebuke.
"I'm afraid the bastards are being clever," Aylmore said, after scanning the water with his glass. The greens had divided, splitting off into two narrow groups, keeping close to the edge of the channel where the current was weakest. They were near enough now for him to see that they were slipstreaming, one green leading the way, making the going easier for those behind. After several minutes, the lead green would fall back to be immediately replaced by another.
"Clever bastards indeed," Aylmore thought.
They entered the cut proper soon after, whereupon the Superior slowed to the equivalent of one-third auxiliary speed. The greens once again proved their cunning by veering away from the banks and into the ship's wake. With the frigate acting as a breakwater, they were soon able to close on the stern, approaching in a dense pack that stretched away for at least 300 yards.
"Range 50 yards, sir,"
the lead gunner reported, Aylmore noting how the man's hand shook on his gun's firing lanyard.
"Wait for the order,"
Aylmore instructed, moving without particular haste to stand at the aft rail, hands clasped behind his back as he watched the greens draw closer still. He waited until he could see the sunlight glinting on their scales and shook his head, possessed by a curious sense of regret for what was about to unfold.
"Such foolish things the white makes you do," he thought, turning away and nodding at Steelfine.
"Sequential order, number one. Port to starboard. Fire when ready."
The gun on the far right fired, even before Steelfine had finished shouting the command. The other four followed suit in quick succession. Aylmore moved to the left to gauge the effect of the shot as the crews feverishly began to reload. He could see a patch of red amongst the froth of the Superior's wake, but the greens were still coming on apace. The next salvo raised 5 identical waterspouts amongst the heart of the pack, Aylmore taking satisfaction from the sight of tumbling and torn green bodies raining down in the aftermath.
"Got a dozen at least with that one, lads," he called to the gunners. "Keep it up!"
He wasn't sure the gun crews did in fact manage 4 shots a minute in the time it took them to expend 2/3 of their canister, but if not, it was certainly close. The Superior left a pinkish stain the length of the cut. Dead and dying greens rolled and twisted in the current, some calling out plaintive cries before slipping beneath the water. None came within 20 yards of the ship's stern, and the survivors seemed to have abandoned their pursuit, milling about in the center of the cut as the Superior drew away. The guns fired once more before Aylmore called out a ceasefire order. The canister launched at too great a range to have any effect, but the crews let out a triumphant cheer anyway.
"A good day's work, sir,"
Steelfine commented, as they surveyed the carnage churning in their wake.
"Actually, no, number one, it isn't," Aylmore replied. "We appear to have been expelled from the upper Torquil, making our mission markedly more difficult. We'll have to find another location to retrieve the expedition."
"Sir!"
he trailed off, as one of the riflemen he had assigned to the bridge approached at a run, coming to a halt and offering a quick salute.
"Mr. Talmont's compliments, sir. He requests your presence on the bridge."
The man's shoulders slumped a little, face grim as he added,
"There are more of them ahead, sir. Hundreds of the buggers, sealing the far end of the cut."
"Chased us right into a trap, and I fell for it."
Aylmore's hands bunched into fists at the small of his back, as he sought to keep the combined anger and self-reproach from his features. He had ordered the Superior to 1/2 auxiliary power, which, thanks to the inrushing tidal surge, kept them in a stationary position, a half mile from the southern mouth of the cut. He stood at the Superior's prow along with Steelfine and Zenita, surveying the mass of greens that filled the exit from the channel. There were so many it seemed as if they formed a solid barrier of drake flesh, far too thick to blast their way through with the ammunition they had left.
"We could wait for the tide to shift," Zenita suggested. "Fire up the blood burner when it does and charge them."
"They'll swarm the ship," Aylmore said. "We can fortify the upper works, sir," Steelfine said. "Seal all the hatches and shift the cannon to the walkways."
The islander's features were rigid, but Aylmore saw the truth in his eyes clearly. A desperate ploy, but better than nothing. One thing was clear. They couldn't just sit here and wait to run out of fuel.
"Very well," he said. "Form parties to gather anything we can use as a barricade."
He fell silent as a roar sounded from the mouth of the cut, turning in time to see a column of flame erupt from the center of the green barrier. The drakes let out an immediate shrill chorus of alarm as a very large blue shape burst through their ranks. Jack continued to belch out fire as he rose amongst them, turning the sea to steam and boiling the greens who thrashed around him. Then, as the flames died, he arched his massive body and brought his tail up and down in a blow that shook the ship as he whipped it into the mass of flailing drakes.
"Get to the engine room,"
Aylmore told Zenita, who was already running for the hatch.
"Full power to the blood burner,"
he called after her before turning to Steelfine.
"Take charge of the pivot gun. Fire as she bears."
Aylmore sprinted for the bridge, hauling himself up the ladder in a rapid scramble. The order he was about to give Scrimshine proved unnecessary, as the ship lurched into forward motion and the helmsman spun the wheel to aim her at the opening Jack had torn in the cordon of greens.
"Thought the bastard was a coward,"
he said, as Aylmore moved to his side.
"Not today, it seems."
Flames rose again as they sped forward, Jack casting the jet of fire all around him. The death cries of the greens rose to ear-piercing levels as the Superior charged into the remnants of their barrier. A stream of fire flashed over the foredeck, blinding Aylmore for a second. He blinked and wiped at his eyes, looking again to see Jack's head rising to port with a pair of struggling greens clamped in his jaws. The blue bit down and shook his head, the greens coming apart in an explosion of blood and shredded flesh. Jack opened his mouth wide, sword-length teeth gleaming red and white as he dived down in search of fresh prey. Flames licked at the Superior's flanks as she exited the mouth of the cut, a last desperate attempt by the drakes to bar their escape that did little damage. Only one green appeared on the foredeck, a burnt, ragged thing that struggled over the rail to stagger about, coughing flame in all directions, until a blast of canister from the pivot gun tore it to pieces. Then they were through, the smoke and billowing steam clearing to reveal the welcome sight of the lower Torquil.
"Maintain speed and heading,"
Aylmore said, before going out onto the walkway and turning to the stern. He could see Jack still assailing the greens, but now they were fighting back, dozens of them leaping clear of the water to belch fire at his head, whilst others clamped themselves onto his coils, biting furiously at his scales. The great blue let out a roar of pain and rage, his flames incinerating a half dozen greens as he thrashed his massive body. But there were more boiling out of the sea. Within moments, Jack was covered in them, clinging like leeches to his hide. The weight of so much flesh inevitably began to bear him down, though he fought and bit and roasted his enemies to the end. Aylmore closed his eyes as Jack's head disappeared beneath the surface in a cloud of steam, his last roar swallowed by a sea stained dark with drake blood.
"Report from the crow's nest, sir," Talmont called from the bridge. "More greens to the east."
Hialmor tore his gaze from the scene of Jack's demise, training his glass on the eastern horizon. The green pack was a good way off, 4 miles or more, even larger than those they had already encountered and approaching fast. Every aquatic green in the Torquils, he thought, returning to the bridge. Defeat was not a pleasant sensation, but to deny it would make him a poor excuse for a captain.
Mr. Scrimshine, he said, steer due south. We are quitting the Torquils.
Chapter 19. Lizanne.
I can see where it got its name,
Takela commented, pulling back on the control lever so the firefly ascended into a bank of cloud, the tall spike of the high wall fading from view beneath. The Okanis family had chosen to construct its seat in the crater of a long-extinct volcano. The narrow peak rose from the sea to a height of well over 200 feet. The entire south-facing slope appeared to either have been shorn away by the elements or deliberately removed to be replaced by a wall of smooth granite. A massive iron door lay at the base of the wall, presumably to allow for the comings and goings of the family's ships. Before the cloud closed in, Lizanne had used a spyglass to survey the cluster of buildings nestling in the volcano's crater, marking the largest as a possible barracks and the more narrow but taller structure opposite as the Okanis mansion. There was no sign of alarm in the crater or any indication they had been seen. Lizanne had ordered Takela to stay as high as possible during the approach and make full use of the fortuitously plentiful cloud cover. Also, the hour was late, and the gathering gloom would make them harder still to spot, especially by lookouts accustomed to scanning the sea for likely enemies.
The island 3 miles west, Lizanne said,
pointing at a stretch of sea visible through a gap in the cloud.
It's flat enough for a landing. Wait until dawn tomorrow before picking you up,
Takela finished.
I know.
Steer north, Lizanne said, reasoning there might be fewer sentries facing away from the most likely seaward approach.
Circle until it gets dark.
The cloud cover thinned as evening slipped into night, the two moons casting a long shadow from the high wall and scattering glitter over the sea.
Are you sure this is the best idea?
Takela asked, not for the first time.
It's a tricky piece of flying.
Lizanne rose from her seat, crouching to open the hatch in the floor of the gondola.
I have every confidence in your abilities, she said, pulling on a harness.
It was constructed from strong, heavily stitched leather, with two additional straps above her shoulders that were joined by a steel ring. Once she had buckled the harness into place, Lizanne reached for a 20-yard-long coil of steel cable. One end of the cable was a standard eye-hook, whilst the other was something Jemiah had quickly put together before they set off. She buckled this device onto the harness's steel ring, before leaning down to reach outside and attach the other end to the half-ring on the gondola's underside.
Ready,
she told Takela, swinging her legs into the opening and using the spider to inject a large dose of green.
Engine off,
Takela said, closing the throttle, then taking a firmer hold of the central control lever.
Descending now.
Lizanne jumped as Takela put the aerostat into a steep dive, the force of the wind instantly whipping her back as the cable extended. The green limited the effect of the jarring impact when the cable reached its limit, Lizanne feeling her vertebrae strain with the jolting instant deceleration. The cable scraped over the engine mounting as she swung behind the plummeting firefly, and would have fouled the propellers if they hadn't had the foresight to kill the power. The aerostat continued to dive for about 30 seconds, whereupon Takela pulled back on the control lever and it came to a stop, the firefly rearing backwards. Lizanne continued to plummet, the cable tightening to swing her beneath the gondola at near terminal velocity. The high wall loomed before her as she neared the apex of the swing, the fortified edge of the crater no more than 50 yards away. Lizanne reached up and hit the catch on Jemiah's hook, detaching herself from the cable. The momentum was sufficient to carry her across the edge of the crater and the parapet beyond. As she passed over it, she could see only one sentry, face lit by a glow as he touched a match to his cigarillo, completely oblivious to anything that might be happening above. She landed on the roof of the barracks, displacing several tiles in the process, then sliding to the edge of the roof. Lizanne twisted about and caught hold of the gutter, hanging there in rigid silence. She heard a few raised voices and the rapid tread of boots on cobbles, no doubt drawn by the cascade of falling tiles. Her green-enhanced ears caught much of the subsequent conversation.
Could be goals again.
Too many fallen slates for that. Better take a look.
Do we tell him?
Fuck no.
Lizanne waited for the tread of boot leather to fade, then hauled herself back up onto the roof. It was overlooked by the parapet, and she knew she had only moments before the inquisitive and overly conscientious guard climbed up and raised the alarm. The barracks were separated from the O'Canis mansion by a 20-foot gap, a relatively easy jump for a blood-blessed stoked with green, but requiring a decent run-up and yet more fallen tiles. Instead, Lizanne opted for the shorter jump to the crater wall to the rear of the barracks. It was a rough-hewn cliff face with hand and footholds aplenty, enabling her to latch on and descend rapidly into the shadows below. Upon reaching the ground, she immediately sprinted towards the mansion, disappearing into the refuge of the house's shadowed rear in the space of a few heartbeats. Given the lack of alarm, she had successfully avoided the attentions of the inquisitive guard. Scanning the rear edifice of the mansion, she saw lights in the ground-level windows, but none in the floors above. Intelligence on this place had been meager, garnered from the few sailors and refugees she could find with some familiarity of Verestian waters. Only one, a former Blue Hunter hand, recently recruited into Madame Hackigan's militia, had actually been to the high wall, but never reached these lofty heights.
"They're a right suspicious bunch to be sure, miss," the man had said. "Don't let visiting sailors wander from their docks, though there's rumours of all manner of treasure in the upper reaches of that mountain."
Lizanne, of course, wasn't interested in treasure tonight. Merely maps and documents which experience told her would most likely be found on the first floor. The mansion was a close copy of a larger-than-average Mandalorian country house, the kind purchased by the upper-middle rank of the corporate managerial class, desirous of a refuge from the odorous bustle of city life. She had had occasion to burgle such places before, and the study would normally be found opposite the stairwell on the first-floor landing. Quickly identifying the correct window, she moved to the mansion wall and launched herself upwards, the green ensuring she gained purchase on the windowsill some 12 feet off the ground. Hoisting herself up, she was gratified to find only a basic latch on the window, easily opened after a fractional injection of black. She used the remaining black to draw the window up and swiftly swung herself inside, crouching to survey the room with her enhanced vision. After a few seconds of squinting at brooms, buckets, and a variety of mops, she realized she had chosen the wrong access point after all. "Getting rusty," she chided herself, moving to press her ear to the door of what was plainly a closet. She could hear a faint murmur of voices from the lower floor, 2 or 3, all male. The words were indistinct, but the pitch was casual, lacking in urgency. Lizanne found the door unlocked and eased it open, seeing an empty landing and 2 stairwells, one leading up, the other down. Spotting another door opposite the cupboard, she stole out onto the landing, moving in a slow crouch, her feet testing each floorboard before putting her full weight on it. She found the other door secured by a heavy Alebond Commodities double mortise lock, indicating something of value might well lie on the other side. Another injection of black, and some careful probing later, and she was in, closing the door softly behind her. The room was fully dark and the windows shuttered, so even with green in her veins, It took a moment to confirm she had in fact found the study this time. However, it was more of a library-cum-map room, the walls lined with book-laden shelves from floor to ceiling, whilst a number of chart-bearing easels were arranged around a large central map table. Not so rusty, after all. Lazan allowed herself a small compliment as she went to the map table. Laid out on its surface beneath a thick sheet of glass was the largest complete map of the Aradzian continent she had ever seen. It was clearly several decades old from the foxing that discolored the edges of the paper, but it also appeared to be remarkably accurate, albeit also heavily modified. Annotations in dense Forestian script had been scribbled all around the coast and at some places in the mostly blank interior. Lizanne's interest peaked, however, as her gaze tracked across the chart to Crystalline Lake, where the annotations became a jumbled, overlapping frenzy.
Growl?
Lizanne's gaze snapped to the underside of the table, finding a pair of green eyes blinking up at her from the gloom. The cat slinked out of the shadows and wound itself around her legs, tail swishing. Lizanne ignored it and returned to the map, peering closer at the cloud of scribbles around the lake. Her spoken Verestian was perfect, but her understanding of the written form less so. It was a curious mode of text, in that it mixed pictography with phonetics, making rapid translation difficult. Current becomes a vortex here, she murmured, a finger tapping a notation next to a series of circular arrows. It was marked with several cruciform squiggles, she knew to be the equivalent of a Mandalorian exclamation mark. The cat let out another plaintive meow, then purred as it prodded her calf with its head. Keen to quiet the animal, Lizanne crouched and gathered it up, stroking it as she continued to examine the map. Large as it was, the depiction of Crystalline Lake still lacked sufficient detail for her to identify a precise location. She gauged the swirl of arrows as about 60 miles south of the falls that fed the lake, and at least 3 miles from shore, but doubted that would be enough for Clay and his contractors to pinpoint it. She stepped back from the map, turning her attention to the easels that surrounded it. She carried the cat to the closest one, the furry bundle purring as she scratched under its chin. The map was a detailed scientific study of the lake, marked with the crest of the Consolidated Research Company. Various depths were depicted and coded in different colors, and likely concentrations of draconic activity outlined in green ink. But the map itself gave no clues as to the location of what had so obsessed the late patriarch of the Okanis clan. She examined each of the easels in turn, finding them all detailed renderings of various regions of Crystalline Lake, until she came to one that was plainly an enlarged version of the region with the swirling currents. The arrows depicting the vortex were drawn with more care, some rendered in black, others red, and often marked with the Verestian equivalent of a question mark. However, what drew most of her attention was the large X in the center of the vortex. The notation next to it was unusual, in that it wasn't written in Verestian, but something that resembled the flowing elegance of Dalcian. Ancient Dalcian, she decided, recalling what Clay had told her about the original legend regarding the treasure of Crystalline Lake. She didn't know this script, and therefore couldn't translate it, but was sure if she had, it would have read, "A vessel of wonder, unbound by earth or sea, come to rest with precious cargo neath the silver waters." "I do believe," Lizanne said, giving the cat a hug, "I may have found what I came for." The cat squirmed in her arms, suddenly agitated. A flicker of movement drew Lizanne's gaze to a nearby bookcase, finding another cat perched atop it. Unlike the grey tabby she held, this one was black, and considerably larger. Also, judging by the white teeth it bared at Lizanne as it hissed, much less desirous of petting. "Don't do that," Lizanne said, patting the cat she held on the head.
See? I'm nice.
The black cat, however, seemed unimpressed, its hiss becoming louder still as it lowered itself for a pounce. The cat in Lazanne's arms let out a frightened growl and tore itself free, bounding off into the gloomy recesses of the study, swiftly pursued by its darker cousin. Soon came the sound of tumbled books and furniture as the cats raced around the room, letting out a chorus of shrieks and hisses as they did so. From the sound of raised voices from below, it was evident the commotion hadn't been missed. Lizanne snapped her gaze back to the map on the easel, trained eyes drinking in every detail in the space of a few seconds. Hearing keys rattling in the door's lock, she ran to the nearest window. The shutters were locked, so she injected black and tore them away before shattering the window itself. She leapt through just as the door to the study burst open. A pistol shot boomed behind her as she tumbled into space, followed by a stern rebuke in Verestian.
No firing, shitbrain! I need her alive!
Lizanne landed amidst a cluster of rose bushes in the mansion's small garden. Tearing herself free and ignoring the sting of thorns, she refreshed her green and ran for a stairwell carved into the surrounding crater wall. As she scaled the steps, a man leapt down from above to land in front of her, swinging the butt of a carbine at her head, then finding himself tumbling through the air as she blasted him aside with black. Below, light flooded the crater as torches and lanterns sprang to life, accompanied by a chorus of shouts and orders. Loudest amongst the babble of voices was one calling for,
Morva! Get up here, you lazy bitch!
Messy, Lizanne reproached herself as she neared the top of the stairwell. Next time, just throttle any cats.
A five-strong squad of sentries charged at her when she got to the parapet, arms locked and grouped together in a tight bunch in the hope it might protect them. They were wrong. She swept their legs away with a wave of black, sending them all sprawling face first onto the parapet. Lizanne leapt the struggling quintet, landing atop the battlement and pausing to gauge the distance to the crashing waves below. It would be the highest dive she had ever attempted, but survivable with sufficient green in her veins and black to part the water as she came down. Lizanne leapt, her form perfect, legs straight and toes pointed, arms outstretched, then pulled forward and hands clasped together. The air rushed out of her lungs as an invisible fist closed about her chest, holding her in midair for a second before dragging her backwards. She managed to cushion the impact with black, sending out a pulse just before she collided with the cobbled surface of the courtyard to the front of the mansion. She rolled as she landed, jerking to the side as a wave of heated air told of a near miss with red. Lizanne whirled and dodged, gaze roaming the courtyard for her assailant, taking in the onlooking cordon of Verestians. They were all carrying weapons, and many were in a state of undress, having just been roused from their beds. The Bloodblessed wasn't hard to find. A tall, slim figure standing apart from the others, female with a scarlet headscarf. She stood with her arms crossed and head tilted, in a way that put Lizanne in mind of the cat that had just undone her mission. It didn't improve her mood. She sent a contained blast of her own black straight at the woman's face, then followed it with one to the chest as she dodged aside, Lizanne experiencing the satisfaction of watching her opponent spun into an untidy pirouette by the force of the blow. The woman let out a frustrated yelp, bounding upright in an impressive display of agility and letting loose with a stream of red. It was an undisciplined riposte, one Lizanne easily evaded with a green-enhanced leap that brought her to a height of 20 feet, whereupon she pinned the woman to the cobbles with a stream of black. Lizanne drew both her revolvers and landed astride the woman's prostrate form, leveling one pistol at her forehead as she tracked the other across the surrounding Verestians. They all raised their own weapons with a metallic rattle of drawn hammers and chambered rounds. They held a mix of carbines and pistols, along with the occasional shotgun.
Lizanne knew in an instant the chances of evading so many projectiles at once were non-existent. And given the confident anticipation on their faces, so did they.
"Kill her if you want,"
said one of the Verestians, a bearded fellow of broad stature, who stepped from the cordon with a long-barreled pistol in hand. He cast a withering glance at the woman on the ground, who returned it with a resentful frown.
"My niece has never really earned her salt," he said, sliding the pistol into a shoulder holster. "So you would in fact be doing me a great favor."
Lizanne cast a final glance around at the ring of armed men and women, then slowly raised both pistols above her head.
"My name is Lizanne Lethbridge," she began.
"Miss Blood herself?" the bearded man cut in, eyebrows raised in apparent awe.
However, the awe disappeared almost instantly, and he began to voice a laugh that was soon shared by his compatriots, the sound of their humor echoing through the crater.
"I did rather think it might be,"
he added, once the laughter had faded, inclining his head in a grudging gesture of respect.
"Alzar Lacaris, custodian of the High Wall. And before I hang your worthless corporate hide from said wall, I should very much like to know what you're doing here."
Lizanne replied with an affable nod, smiling to distract him, before dropping the pistol in her right hand and pressing the fourth button on the spider. Alzar Lacaris swore and lunged towards her as she collapsed, blue flooding her veins and dragging her into the deepest trance. Chapter 20. Clay.
"Thank the seer for that,"
Skaggerhill groaned, slipping from the back of the female Serath he had been riding. The animal immediately cantered away to cluster with its kin as the harvester rubbed at the small of his back.
"One more mile would have done for me, I reckon.
I believe we're close enough to walk the rest of the way,"
Lieutenant Sigurol said, looking up from his map.
"Just over 12 miles due east should bring us to the lake's western shore."
Clay leaned forward, then back, to relieve his own aching muscles, casting his gaze over the darkening blue of the sky, broken by Nelfia's pale crescent rising over the eastern horizon.
"It's late," he said. "We'll rest up. Same watch order as last night, lest anyone's got any objections."
Since taking on the primary burden of leadership, he had also assumed the post-midnight watch, generally considered the least desirable, something his uncle had tended to do during their search for the white. He wasn't sure if the absence of argument was due to an acceptance of his leadership or a desire for uninterrupted sleep.
"Would never light a fire out here before,"
Braddon said later, tossing a few sticks into the small but healthy blaze in the center of the camp.
"Would have drawn spoiled by the dozen."
He paused to scan the surrounding plains, the grass whispering faintly beneath the starlit sky.
"Now there's no fresh sign of their passing for miles around. Used to be 6 different tribes on the plains, that we knew of anyways."
"All gone off to fight the White's War," Clay said. "Those that ain't dead already."
"Makes you wonder," Skaggerhill said, "if they got any notion of what they're fighting for, or any say in the matter." "Those that serve the Drake's will surrender their own,"
Preacher said, causing the usual stir of surprise at breaking his customary silence.
"Forgive my ignorance," Sigurol said, "but did the seer predict any of this? His writings have long been banned in the Empire."
"He tried to warn the world of what was to come," Preacher replied, "though there were few who listened."
"I have read all the seer's words more than once," Braddon said. "Don't recall mention of anything that resembles what's happening right now."
Preacher fixed Braddon with a bright-eyed stare of the kind Clay had last seen during their previous visit to Crystalline Lake.
"Then you should have read deeper, Captain,"
the marksman said in a low, intent voice.
"For it's all there,
The travail is at last upon us, and are we not seven in number?
Braddon gave no reply, causing Lauriabeth to pipe up.
What's that got to do with anything?
The seven penitents, Braddon said. The seer claimed that when the forces of darkness rise up during the travail, they'll be opposed by seven penitents.
Seven righteous penitents,
Preacher said, the volume of his voice climbing a notch.
Chosen from amongst the great throng of sinners to stand against the ravaging tide.
He paused, gaze unfocused but gleaming.
I see it now, though I hid from it for many years, though I sundered myself from the church and sought death in the interior, though I have reveled in slaughter of Drake and spoiled and sullied my soul in the reveling. Ever has the truth of the seer's word pursued me, until now, at last, it finds me.
He stood, raising his arms, hands outstretched, fingers spread wide.
Will you pray with me, brothers and sisters? He said, head lowered. Give thanks to the seer for his guidance, and seek his blessing for the task ahead.
Lauriabeth exchanged a brief glance with Clay and her father, before getting to her feet, lip curled in distaste.
Fuck off,
she said wearily, before going to her bedroll.
Wait a second, cuz,
Clay said, bringing her to an uncertain pause. He rose to his feet and went to clasp Preacher's outstretched hand. The marksman gripped it with all the fierceness of a man clinging to wreckage in a stormy sea.
Thank you, brother,
he breathed, head still lowered.
Well, why not?
Clay said, looking at each of them in turn and holding out his own hand.
Reckon we'll be needing all the help we can get before long.
It was Chris who took his hand, albeit with a bemused smile. Braddon moved to clasp Preacher's other hand, extending his own to Skaggerhill, who took it after a moment's hesitation.
Lieutenant?
Chris said, holding her hand out to Sigurol. The Corventine frowned in rueful resignation before joining his hand to hers, muttering,
A man would find himself hung for this in the Empire.
He turned, hand raised expectantly to Lauriabeth. The distaste still lingered on her face, though the sneer disappeared now.
Ma never had no truck with such nonsense,
she said, crossing her arms.
Neither do I.
Please, Laurie, Braddon said. It's just for a second.
Lauriabeth raised her face to the sky, breath misting a little in the chill night air as she let out a soft curse.
As long as he don't take all night about it,
she said, moving to join hands with Sigurd and Skaggerhill, closing the circle.
The final resting place of the seer is unknown to this day,
Preacher said, raising his face, eyes still lit by the same glow of conviction.
For that was his wish. Make no idols of me, he said. My words are my temple and my testament. The seer offered no false promises, no empty lies, that those who followed his words would earn an eternal place in another world or riches in this one. His message was simple. The travail is coming, and now it is here. Of the seven penitents, he said only this. When the storm winds born of the travail blow hardest, when the flames reach highest, when the screams of the damned grow loudest, then will the seven righteous penitents rise. Long will they travel, and much will they suffer. But it is they who will quench the flames and silence the screams, though it cost them all.
Well, that's cheery,
Lauriabeth muttered.
We are seven,
Preacher said, Clay wincing a little as his grip tightened.
Joined in purpose, and now joined in faith. I know the seer blesses our endeavor,
He lowered his gaze once more, saying, "Heed the words of the seer." "Heed the words of the seer," Braddon repeated, Clay and the others doing the same. Silence reigned for a time as they stood there, holding hands in silent contemplation, until, from somewhere out of the darkened plain, there came the shrill cry of a drake.
"Shit!"
Lorribeth drew both pistols and threw herself flat, the circle breaking apart as the rest of them armed themselves and hunkered down.
"Sounded a mite too high-pitched for a green," she said.
"Plains green," Skaggerhill said, drawing back the hammers on his shotgun. "Little smaller than jungle greens, but a good deal more cunning. They move in packs of six or more and hunt at night. Most likely caught the scent of the Serath we rode here on. Be after the young'uns."
"And if they ain't?" Clay asked.
Skaggerhill sighed and reached for his pack, placing it in front of him and laying the shotgun on top.
"Then we're in for a very long night."
Either through blind luck or disinterest, they spent a nervous night untroubled by any greens. Clay eventually ordered the resumption of the watch rota, and each of them managed a few hours' sleep before dawn. They set off after a short breakfast of canned sea rations, washed down with a larger-than-usual quota of coffee to stave off the lingering fatigue. It took two of them to carry Chris's apparatus, the bulky device lashed into a tarpaulin suspended between two poles. Clay had been taking his turn lugging the apparatus when they came upon the body of a juvenile Serath. Flies buzzed in greedy swarms around the empty cavity of the animal's stomach and the many wounds that scored its hide.
"Like I said," Skaggerhill commented, "after the young'uns."
"Got a dead green over here," Braddon said, pointing to something in the long grass nearby.
"Looks like its head got stoved in. Guess Mama Serath got herself some vengeance." "You want to stop and harvest it?" Skaggerhill said. "Won't take too long."
"No," Clay said. He grunted and settled the poles on his shoulders before resuming the trek. "The lake's only a couple miles away, and we already got us a decent stock of green." Crystalline Lake came into view just after noon, the plain suddenly descending in a gentle slope towards the shore that stretched away on either side. The water was as blue and deceptively inviting as Clay remembered, and at this latitude, so broad that the jungle covering the eastern shore was lost to view.
"We're gonna need another boat," Braddon said, "or at least a raft."
"Need some notion of where to look first," Clay said, as he and Sigurol set the apparatus down. "I'll trance with Miss Lethbridge tonight." The rush of fear hit him like a punch, sending him to his knees, a pain-filled yell escaping his clenched teeth as thoughts that were not his own flooded his head. A great host of aquatic greens, seen from below, sediment billowing, Jack's huge heart hammering in alarm as he let out a plaintive warning cry.
"Clay?"
His uncle was at his side, holding him as he convulsed, Jack's need for reassurance dominating his thoughts.
"Stop!"
Clay forced the command through Jack's terrorized babble, reaching into the core of his mind to crush the worst of his fear. Jack calmed, his huge body ceasing its desperate coiling as he sought to conceal himself in a cloud of raised sediment. Clay had Jack cast his gaze upwards once more, seeing that the green pack had passed overhead now. They were clustering together on the surface a short way off, forming some kind of barrier. Clay turned Jack about, seeing the narrow hull of the Superior cutting the surface towards them, its wake diminishing as it came to a halt. Jack's incredible hearing was full of the massed clicking and chirping of the greens directly to the Superior's front, and keen enough to detect a similar cacophony of another pack behind. From the way the sound echoed around, he was also able to deduce they were in a narrow channel.
"Got themselves trapped in the cut," Clay realized. "Bet the captain's pissed about that." He centered Jack's gaze on the twisting coil of the green barrier, several yards thick and growing thicker as more drakes swam to join it.
"It's time to fight, Jack," Clay told the blue, which caused an immediate resurgence of his fear. Clay tried to calm him again, but this time the terror couldn't be stemmed.
"I'm sorry," Clay said, guilt and resignation mingling in his heart. "But I need last look for this." He dived deep into the blue's memories, pulling together all the messy remnants of Jack's life, forming them into an ugly ball that throbbed with violence. Clay pushed himself into the ball, fighting nausea at the bloodlust he found. Rummaging through the shifting mass of slaughter and madness, felt like sinking his hands into a charnel house trough. Finally, he found what he was looking for, the still-living core that had been last looked Jack. It was a dark, twisted thing, denuded of much of its being, but still holding on to all that useful hatred.
"See them?" Clay asked it, focusing the blue's gaze on the greens once more.
"They ain't drakes. They're men." He took an image of one of the greens and remolded it, shrinking the tail and growing the limbs, sculpting the head into a ball rather than a spear. Jack's hunger swelled at the sight, then blossomed further as Clay spread the remade image of the green to its brethren. Within seconds, what had been a mass of drake flesh had become a mass of men, and Jack required no further encouragement. The shared awareness began to fragment as Jack surged upwards into the greens, flame erupting from his mouth. Clay felt himself convulse as the subsequent kaleidoscope of horrors played out, man after man roasted or snapped into bloody remnants, except they weren't men. Even at his worst, Jack had never experienced such an ecstasy of vengeance. His mind exulted with it, as if this were the pinnacle of his quest to rid the seas of humankind. Clay was vaguely aware of the superior passing by, but Jack was too preoccupied with his feast to pay the ship much mind. Soon, however, he began to feel pain amongst the fury, Clay's hands scrabbling at his body as he felt the greens tear at his hide. He started to choke and gasp as the weight of them bore him down, greens worrying their way past his scales to the flesh beneath, whilst flames licked at Jack's eyes. Clay let out a groan as ever more of the blue's blood seeped into the sea, and his mind became a distant, withered remnant.
"I'm sorry, Jack," he sent the thought after the blue, as his mind flickered in the depths, flared bright for one last second, and then died. "I'm so sorry."
He didn't wake until the next morning, blinking the blur from his gaze to find a ring of concerned faces staring down at him.
"Told you he weren't dying,"
Lauriebeth said, poking Sigurol in the ribs.
"Fever's gone,"
Chris said, crouching to press a hand to his forehead.
"Your temperature was a little alarming for a while."
Clay shook his head, finding he had only the most dim recollection of the previous few hours. There had been dreams, he knew that, but he had a sense of being fortunate not to remember them.
"What was that?"
Chris asked.
"Has it happened to you before?"
"Jack died," Clay said, climbing to his feet. "The ship ain't waiting for us in the Torquils no more. We'll have to find another way back to it." He shrugged away their helping hands and turned his gaze to the lake. Jack's demise kept replaying in his head, provoking a sick, guilty jab at his gut with every repetition.
"Uncle's right," he said. "We need a raft. Time to find some trees."
Constructing a raft of sufficient dimensions took 2 full days, much of the time spent harvesting the necessary wood from the infrequent trees found on the lake's western shore. Chris oversaw the design, whilst Skaggerhill and Sigurol did the bulk of the construction, they being the most familiar with watercraft. When it was done, they had a square platform some 12 feet wide, complete with 4 oars for steering. They carried it to the shore for a test launch, which confirmed it could actually float and bear the weight of Kriz's apparatus.
Now we just need somewhere to look,